Menards Black Friday sale is here. Get everything you need to bring home the holidays. A Nerf Blaster dog toy blasts tennis balls 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious Dubai chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing squish lamps and Performax drill bit sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Hurry in while supplies last. Good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details.
Hey guys, this right here is going to be pharmacology, and I'm still trying to figure out how I want to do pharmacology. And yes, I'm halfway through the course and I still don't know how I want to upload it. And it's because pharmacology is such a weird subject. It's either you get it or you don't. There is no middle ground with pharmacology. But I'm just going to upload a drug from a class, for instance, like fluoxetine is an SSRI or metoprolol is a beta blocker. Now, if you need something that is more in depth on a particular drug, then I will let you go and search that out yourself. Like, for instance, metoprolol is a beta blocker. And then labetalol is also a beta blocker, but it is also an alpha blocker as well. So if you guys need that type of particular stuff for a particular drug, then I will let you go out and find that out yourself. But labetalol is also a beta blocker. So you're looking at the apical pulse for 60 seconds. You have your blood pressure guidelines before you can give it and not give it. So stuff like that. I'm probably just going to keep this intro for the rest of the pharmacology drugs out there. That way you guys can know, like, hey, this is an SSRI. This is what SSRIs do. Or this is an SNRI. This is what SNRIs do. Or this is a TCA. This is what TCAs do. Stuff like that. So just because you can really get into the weeds of stuff and then have so many drugs on this podcast that you will never be able to find the right one that you need. So it's just going to be a drug from a drug class. And then if you need more information, like the labetalol example, then that will be on you to be a prudent student, nurse, or whatever it is that you are, to find out what you need to know for your particular nursing school exams or your particular state boards. But I'm just going to be uploading a drug from a class and then letting it ride like that. So I hope you guys enjoy. I'm still trying to figure this stuff out. Thank you for listening. Again, if you like the show, like it. If you want to leave a comment, go for it. Leave a review, whatever. Also check out the ACLS stuff. I uploaded it as well. So if you need ACLS for your work or you need a recert, then by all means, the material that is straight from the AHA's ACLS book is on the podcast and they go over it. And I even broke it down into certain sections like stroke, like ACS, like respiratory failure and everything else. Okay. So give that a listen. And as other certifications of mine come due, like PALS and TNCC and ABLS and ASLS and whatever, I'll be uploading those materials too. That way you guys can stop by and listen and it'll help you out in your practice. But again, this is pharmacology and this is how I think I'm going to be doing it from now on. So I hope you guys enjoy.
Oh boy, got some blood going.
Yeah, blood.
Well, he's wearing it too.
Welcome to the bed. When you get over to the bed, we'll go ahead and give you the story. This is all going to happen super fast. Welcome to the emergency room.
70-year-old female, single driver of a vehicle. Appears that she went off-road into a ditch, rolled over her car onto a trailer, caved in the top of the vehicle, was caved in, so she was hanging out parked in the window.
We have 22 in your left hand.
Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we're taking on a big one, trying to turn this pile of complex pharmacology data into something you can actually use, like a rapid recall clinical study guide.
Yeah, absolutely.
We're dissecting haloperidol. You probably know it as Haldol. It's foundational, especially in emergency psych.
Oh, absolutely. A cornerstone.
But it's also loaded with risks, serious risks. So you need that non-negotiable clinical precision.
You really do. This is definitely a high-stakes review. Haloperidol, it's a powerful drug. High potency, first gen, you know, the conventional antipsychotics.
Right.
And it's the textbook example of a drug with a narrow therapeutic index.
Meaning that line between helping and hurting is, well, thin. Very
it's incredibly small, yeah. Mm-hmm. So we absolutely have to prioritize the need to know stuff, the specifics on administration, how you stratify risk, mm-hmm. and maybe most critical of all, the really lethal drug interactions.
Got it.
If you're giving Haldol, doesn't matter if it's for acute agitation or you know, long-term management, every single decision you make carries a lot of weight.
Exactly. And it's got that dual purpose, right? Great for the immediate crisis, that acute agitation, mm-hmm. but also indispensable sometimes for chronic stuff like schizophrenia or Tourette's.
That's right.
So we're structuring this to follow how you'd think about it clinically. Start with the basics, the mechanics, then why you'd use it, the indications.
Yeah, the why.
Then hit those big red flags around administration and really zero in on the life-threatening side effects and those tricky drug metabolism interactions.
Sounds like a plan. Mm. Let's unpack its basic properties first, because understanding where it worked, that tells you exactly where you should expect the problems to start.
Makes sense. Laying the groundwork. Mm-hmm. Okay, let's simplify the mechanism. Why do we call haloperidol a conventional antipsychotic, and what's its main job biochemically?
Well, it primarily targets the brain's dopamine system. It's mainly a potent dopamine receptor antagonist. Mm-hmm. Specifically, it blocks the D2 receptors. And that D2 antagonism, that's what gives the strong therapeutic effect against, you know, the positive symptoms of psychosis, mm-hmm. hallucinations, delusions.
The things people often associate with psychosis.
Exactly. Those symptoms are often linked to too much dopamine activity, specifically in the mesolimbic pathway.
So that antagonism, that D2 blocking, it's the fix, but it's also the source of the problems, isn't it?
Precisely. That potent D2 blocking doesn't just happen neatly in the mesolimbic pathway. It happens all over the brain, including the nigrostriatal pathway. Mm. And when you block dopamine there, well, you inherently crank up the risk for movement disorders.
Which are the classic side effects everyone worries about with these older antipsychotics?
They are the hallmark adverse effects of this entire class, yeah.
Okay. So knowing how it works, let's look at why we use it. What are the official FDA-approved indications?
The main FDA-approved uses are schizophrenia and then separately Tourette's disorder, specifically for controlling the tics and the vocal utterances in Tourette's. Mm-hmm. But honestly, where haloperidol really shines and why it's often the first drug reached for in an emergency is in those acute high-stakes settings.
That's the key distinction, isn't it? The acute crisis versus the long-term chronic picture.
Absolutely correct. The immediate release IM, the intramuscular injection, super effective for rapidly getting control of acute agitation.
Like in the ER.
Exactly. Could be someone having an acute psychotic break, maybe mania, maybe even really severe delirium. Speed is the name of the game there.
And for the long haul.
For chronic management, especially if you've got patients who struggle with taking meds regularly, adherence issues. Mm-hmm. Then we shift gears to the haloperidol decanoate. That's the long-acting intramuscular depot injection designed for prolonged treatment of schizophrenia.
So it gives you steady levels over time.
Right. Consistent drug levels over weeks, which really helps cut down the risk of relapse just because someone missed a few oral doses.
That difference, immediate IM for a crisis, decanoate depot for maintenance, that's like rule number one, basic stuff everyone needs to know.
Foundational knowledge, absolutely.
But what about those other uses, the off-label ones? Where does Haldol show up that might, you know, surprise people?
Oh, the off-label applications are pretty widespread, especially in critical care.
Like the ICU.
Exactly. The major one is managing delirium, particularly hyperactive delirium. You see it a lot in the ICU, sometimes the PICU, the pediatric ICU.
Okay.
But we have to flag this immediately and strongly. While it is used in these critical settings, it's often given intravenously IV.
And IV Haldol is?
Not FDA approved.
Yeah.
Major red flag. We'll definitely unpack that in detail later. It's a huge point.
Wow. Okay, so it says a lot about how effective it can be that doctors will use a non-approved route when things are really hitting the fan with a patient.
It really does. Beyond critical care, haloperidol has this kind of fascinating niche use for persistent singultus.
Single what now?
Intractable hiccups.
But the gups, seriously.
Yeah, the kind that just won't stop, really impacting someone's life. The clinical sources mentioned that 2 to 5 milligrams IM has actually been effective when nothing else works.
Huh. Learn something new.
But it's definitely reserved for severe cases, not your average bout of hiccups.
Okay, that makes more sense. And what about kids, pediatric populations? The risk of movement disorders seems so high, I guess it's not used often.
Absolutely. Mm. You have to be extremely cautious. In kids, it's strictly a second-line agent because of that significant risk profile.
So only if other things fail?
Pretty much. It's occasionally used for really severe behavioral problems. Think conditions like oppositional defiant disorder, ODD, or severe ADHD, but specifically when you have extreme hyperactivity and aggressive conduct issues.
Right.
Even then, the maximum daily dose for children is tightly restricted. Sources usually cap it at 6 milligrams per day orally.
6 milligrams max, okay.
And it's also sometimes considered for irritability linked to autistic disorder. But again, only if the newer atypical antipsychotics haven't worked, mainly because of that higher risk of tardive dyskinesia in younger patients.
Right, that long-term movement issue. Okay, let's shift gears. Therapeutic effects. If the drug is working, what should we be looking for, and what are the typical dose ranges?
Okay, so for long-term schizophrenia symptom control, your target maintenance dose, orally, is usually somewhere in the 6 to 12 milligram per day range.
6 to 12, oral, daily.
But, you know, in adults who have really severe refractory symptoms, sometimes doses can go much higher, even up to 100 milligrams daily, though that needs incredibly intense monitoring.
Wow, 100 milligrams. Okay.
And for Tourette's? For Tourette's, the goal is obviously reducing the tics and the vocalizations. The average adult dose usually ends up around 15 milligrams per day, again, orally.
15 milligrams for Tourette's. Got it. And back to that high-stakes acute agitation situation, how fast does it work and what are the doses?
Acute agitation control can be quite rapid with IM. Doses are usually small to start, maybe 5 milligrams IM.
Okay.
And you can repeat that dose every 20 to 30 minutes if needed, as needed. But, and this is critical, you have to stick to a strict total daily dose limit.
Which,
for the immediate release parenteral form, it should not go over 20 milligrams total per day.
20 milligrams IM max per day.
Exceeding that 20 milligram total dramatically increases the risk of those dangerous cardiac side effects we mentioned.
Which perfectly tees up our next section, the critical details of administration. Right. This is where the pharmacology rubber meets the road. Critical nursing actions right here. Let's start simple. Oral route. What are the key things to remember for giving Haldol by mouth?
Oral is, yeah, relatively straightforward. You can give it with food. That often helps cut down on potential GI irritation, which is pretty common.
Okay, food's fine. What else?
The tricky part comes with the liquid concentrate form.
Ah, the drops.
Exactly. If you're mixing that concentrate with, say, juice or food, you absolutely must avoid mixing it with coffee or tea.
No coffee, no tea. Why is that specifically? Is it like grapefruit juice with statins?
Sort of, but different mechanism. The sources say mixing the liquid Haldol concentrate with coffee or tea might cause the drug to precipitate.
Precipitate, like fall out of the solution.
Exactly. It could form little solid bits, which means the patient might not get the full intended dose, or it might not be consumed uniformly.
Okay, so inconsistent dosing. Got it. Anything else with the concentrate?
Yes. There's also a small but real risk of contact dermatitis, or whoever's administering it.
Oh, for the nurse or caregiver?
Yeah. You need to be careful. Avoid getting the concentrate on your skin. Usually means using a calibrated pipette for accuracy and cleaning up any spills right away. Gloves are a good idea.
Good tip. No coffee, no tea, protect your skin. Simple enough. Okay, moving to the injections. Let's cover the decanoate depot first, the long-acting one.
Haloperidol decanoate. This one has absolutely zero room for error in how you give it. Zero tolerance.
Okay, lay it out.
First, it must be deep intramuscular injection only. Deep IM.
Emphasize the deep IM.
Absolutely. It is completely contraindicated, forbidden, to give this depot formulation intravenously. Never ithy.
Never for decano. Why? Because it's oil-based.
Exactly. It's suspended in sesame oil. Injecting that 5E could cause a serious pulmonary oil microembolism, which can be fatal.
Okay, deadly mistake. Got it. What else for decanoate?
Second point, volume. To avoid causing too much pain or damaging the muscle tissue, the maximum volume you should inject into a single site is 3 milliliters.
3 mL max per site.
Correct. And the standard recommendation is to use a 21-gauge needle to make sure you're getting it deep enough into the muscle.
Deep IM, never IV, 3 mL max, 21-gauge needle. Clear. Now, the big one. The IV administration of the other form, the immediate release, haloperidol lactate.
This is it. The absolute biggest red flag in our whole discussion.
Yeah.
Potentially lethal detail right here.
So let's be clear.
IV push of haloperidol lactate is officially not FDA approved. Not for any population.
Not approved. Full stop.
Full stop. And yet, as we mentioned earlier, it's still a pretty common off-label practice you see in our ICUs around the world.
Why? if it's not approved and known to be risky,
usually for rapid chemical restraint or managing really severe hyperactive delirium when maybe giving an IM shot is physically impossible or just wouldn't work fast enough. Think intubated patient, seizing patient, someone extremely combative.
Okay. So if a clinician is in that tough spot, they weigh the risks, the benefits, and decide the clinical need is so high they have to use this non-approved 4V route. What are the absolute life-saving rules they must follow?
The rule is manage the cardiac risk. Because IV use is directly linked to a significantly higher risk of QT prolongation and torsade de pointe, TDP.
Torsade, that twisting rhythm. Very bad news.
Very bad. It's a rapid, irregular ventricular rhythm that can quickly degenerate into ventricular fibrillation and sudden cardiac death, especially risky if the dose goes over 20 milligrams total in a short period.
So how do you mitigate that extreme risk if you must give it IV?
You slow it down. The injection has to be given as a slow V push, like over several minutes.
It's not slammed in.
Definitely not. Or even better, you give it as a slow infusion, maybe over 30 to 45 minutes if it's a loading dose.
Why does slowing it down help?
It minimizes that peak concentration of the drug hitting the heart muscle all at once, reduces the immediate risk of sharp drops in blood pressure, oversedation, and those instant extrapyramidal side effects too.
Okay, slow push or slow infusion. That makes the monitoring absolutely critical then. What do you need right there at the bedside?
Continuous ECG monitoring, mandatory, no exceptions.
What are you watching for on the monitor?
You're watching that QTC interval like a hawk, looking for any dangerous prolongation if you see the QTC stretching out or any hint of arrhythmia.
You act immediately.
Immediately. There's no wait and see. The risk of TDP developing is just too high and too fast.
Makes sense. Okay, crisis averted, patient is stable, time to switch back to oral meds. How do you handle that transition from parenteral, like the IM or maybe even that risky IV, back to pills?
The transition needs to be smooth to keep the drug levels steady and avoid relapse. The first dose of oral haloperidol should ideally be given within 12 to 24 hours after the last parenteral dose.
12 to 24 hours? Okay.
Yeah, that ensures the plasma concentration stays therapeutic as the body metabolizes and clears that last injection.
All right, we've hammered home that Haldol is powerful but risky. Now let's get practical and prioritize these side effects. This is where sharp clinical judgment really matters, you know, saves a life or prevents something irreversible. Let's start at the top. Life-threatening, immediate action required.
Number one, absolutely, is the cardiac risk we just talked about. Torsade de pointes, other ventricular arrhythmias, even cardiac arrest.
And these happen fast.
Can be very rapid onset. Directly linked, like we said, to high doses, the IV route especially, or drug interactions that mess with his metabolism. Intervention is basically immediate ACLS protocols and stopping the drug.
Okay, cardiac arrest is obviously top priority. What's the other big, scary, life-threatening thing, the one that might sneak up a bit more slowly?
That would be neuroleptic malignant syndrome.
NMS.
NMS.
The nightmare scenario.
It really is. The onset might be delayed a bit compared to TDP, but it is an absolute medical emergency, no question.
Clinically, what does NMS look like? What are the key signs?
It's characterized by this really severe combination of symptoms, usually a triad. First, hyperthermia, a high fever, often spikes really quickly.
Fever, got it.
Second, profound muscle rigidity, like lead pipe rigidity. So severe it can cause muscle breakdown, rhabdomyolysis, which then threatens the kidneys.
Rigidity, okay. Fever, rigidity. What's the third?
Autonomic instability. That means vital signs are all over the place. Blood pressure fluctuating wildly, heart rate unstable.
So how does the team spot this and what's the first move?
Spotting it means being vigilant for that triad. Any patient on haloperidol who suddenly develops an unexplained high fever and becomes rigid, NMS should be top of your differential.
And the first nursing action?
Stop the drug immediately. That's priority one. Then it's all about aggressive supportive care. Cooling blankets, IV fluids for hydration, and often specific medications like dantrolene for the muscle rigidity, maybe bromocriptine to help restore some dopamine balance. If you don't recognize and treat NMS fast, the mortality rates are terrifyingly high.
Okay, stop the drug, cool them down, support vitals, crucial. We also can't forget those super fast allergic type reactions, right? The ones that hit the airway.
Absolutely. Anaphylactoid reactions, angioedema, that swelling, especially around the face and throat.
Laryngeal edema.
All right. Swelling of the voice box, bronchospasm. These are acute, happen quickly. Airway compromise is the immediate number one priority there.
Makes sense. Airway first. Anything else in this top tier?
One more. The risk of stroke or other cerebrovascular events like TIAs. Importantly, the sources note these seem to happen more often specifically in elderly patients who are being treated for dementia-related psychosis. Another reason to be cautious in that group.
Okay, that's a heavy list. Moving down a level now to the urgent serious category. Still need action, monitoring, maybe dose changes, symptom management. This is where EPS comes in, right? Extrapyramidal symptoms.
Yes, EPS is almost expected with haloperidol, honestly. Happens in roughly 10% or even more of patients. Clinicians need to recognize the main forms.
Break them down for us.
Okay, first you have akathisia. This is that awful inner restlessness, the inability to sit still. Patients feel like they need to constantly move, pace, shift their weight. Very distressing.
Akathisia. Got it. Next.
Second, dystonic reactions. These are sudden, often really frightening, involuntary muscle spasms. Can be painful. Think lockjaw, trismus, eyes rolling back, oculogyric crisis, neck twisting uncontrollably, torticollis.
Okay, dystonia. Sounds awful. And the third?
Third is pseudoparkinsonism. Looks a lot like Parkinson's disease, hence the name. You see motor slowing, akinesia, maybe a tremor, muscle rigidity, shuffling gait.
So akathisia, dystonia, pseudoparkinsonism. About 10% risk for each. These acute EPS types, they're usually manageable, right? With other meds?
Generally, yes. Anticholinergic drugs like benztropine or diphenhydramine are often used to counteract these acute symptoms.
But the fact that they happen at all signals a risk for something worse down the line.
Exactly. Experiencing acute EPS, especially dystonia, is often seen as a risk factor for developing the more insidious long-term movement disorder, tardive dyskinesia, or TD.
TD. That's the one everyone really dreads because it can be permanent.
It's the crucial long-term monitoring point because, yes, it is often irreversible. It shows up as these involuntary repetitive movements, often the mouth, tongue, lips chewing, puckering, grimacing, can also affect limbs and trunk.
And the risk is especially high in kids, you mentioned.
Very concerning in pediatrics. The sources highlight a really stark statistic. In young children on long-term haloperidol, the reported incidence of TD, or similar withdrawal dyskinesias, is alarmingly high, somewhere between 20% and 34%.
20 to 34%? That's huge.
It's massive.
Yeah.
And it's exactly why haloperidol is reserved for kids only after the less risky atypical antipsychotics have failed, and why you need strict standardized monitoring, like using the Ains scale regularly, if a child is on it long term.
Makes perfect sense. Okay, beyond movement disorders, what other organ systems need close watching for toxicity? What labs do we need?
You have to keep an eye on the major metabolic systems. Hematologically, think blood counts. You need frequent CBC monitoring. Why? To catch rare but serious delayed problems like a granulocytosis.
Dangerously low white blood cells.
Right. Or a plastic anemia or just general leukopenia. Rare but devastating if missed.
Okay, CBCs. What else?
Liver function. Need ongoing LFTs, liver function tests. Because there's a risk, again, delayed onset usually, of hepatic failure, jaundice, or just elevated liver enzymes indicating stress.
LFTs. Got it. And endocrine, hormone balance.
Yes, the endocrine system can be affected too. Specifically, watch out for SIADH syndrome of inappropriate antidiuretic hormone secretion.
SIADH. That leads to?
Leads to the body holding on to too much water, diluting the sodium in the blood. So you get hyponatremia, low sodium, and potentially water intoxication.
So check sodium levels.
Definitely. Monitor sodium levels closely, especially when starting the drug or adjusting the dose, and particularly in vulnerable groups like the elderly, who are more prone to electrolyte imbalances anyway.
Okay. That covers the really serious stuff.
Sure.
Finally, let's touch on the common routine side effects, the ones that aren't usually emergencies, but definitely impact quality of life and need good patient teaching.
Right. These are mostly the anticholinergic effects. Pretty common, reported in maybe 1 to 10% of patients.
Yeah.
Classic ones are xerostomia, dry mouth, and constipation.
Dry mouth, constipation, common medication side effects.
They are, but it's crucial to remember the systemic impact of these anticholinergic effects.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just dry mouth. They also make patients prone to urinary retention.
Trouble peeing.
Exactly. Yep. And they mess with the body's ability to regulate temperature. So increased risk of heat intolerance, even heat stroke, especially if someone's in a hot climate or exercising.
Good point, especially for summer months or certain occupations. What else is common?
Drowsiness and lethargy. Also pretty frequent, maybe up to 10%, usually hits early on.
And that's a safety risk, right?
Huge safety risk. Mm-hmm. Major contributor to falls, accidents, especially in the elderly. So patient teaching has to include clear warnings about driving, operating heavy machinery, you know, until they know how the drug affects them and they feel stable.
Okay, understanding how the body actually handles Haldol, absorbs it, breaks it down, gets rid of it, that's not just, you know, academic. It's key to understanding all those drug interactions and why dosing needs careful adjustment. Let's talk pharmacokinetics, especially metabolism.
Right. Haloperidol is heavily metabolized, broken down in the liver. It relies significantly on the cytochrome P450 enzyme system.
The CYP enzymes.
Exactly. Specifically, it's a substrate for two main ones, CYP2D6 and CYP3A4.
And because it relies on those specific pathways?
It means its plasma concentration, how much drug is actually in the bloodstream, is incredibly sensitive to any other drug that messes with those two enzyme pathways, either speeds them up or slows them down.
Okay, this is where we hit that clinical disaster zone you mentioned, enzyme inducers. Drugs that basically put the liver into overdrive for metabolizing Haldol.
Yes. Drugs like carbamazepine Tegretol, which is a common anticonvulsant and mood stabilizer.
Right.
And rifampin, a really potent antibiotic used for TB and other infections. These are strong CYP enzyme inducers.
So they make the liver chew up Haldol faster.
Much faster. And if you use them concurrently with haloperidol, the result is often a major, sometimes clinically catastrophic, drop in haloperidol levels. Loss of efficacy.
How big a drop are we talking?
The source data is shockingly precise on this. Giving haloperidol with strong inducers like rifampin cuts the haloperidol plasma concentrations by an average of 70%.
70%? Wow. That's not a minor tweak. That's like the drug practically disappears.
It's huge. It basically means the therapeutic effect vanishes.
So what does that 70% drop actually look like in a patient?
It looks like a rapid, severe psychotic relapse. The blood level plummets below what's needed. Symptoms come roaring back. You might see this documented as increased scores on psychiatric rating scales, like the BPRS.
So the patient who is stable suddenly isn't.
Exactly. Highly agitated again, delusional, hallucinating, maybe aggressive. The nursing intervention here is critical.
Mm-hmm.
You have to anticipate this. If a known inducer like rifampin or carbamazepine is being added to a patient already on Haldol,
you need a massive dose increase of Haldol.
Massive. Often tripling or even quadrupling the original haloperidol dose just to maintain the same therapeutic effect. And you need to monitor the patient's symptoms like crazy during that transition.
Okay, adding an inducer means big Haldol dose increase. What about the flip side? What if the patient stops taking the inducer?
Equally dangerous, maybe even more acutely so. If that inducer, let's say carbamazepine, is stopped, the liver suddenly slams on the brakes. Haloperidol metabolism slows right back in.
So the Haldol levels.
They spike. Dramatically. The sources mentioned potential increases of like 3.3-fold almost overnight.
Whoa. And that spike means?
Immediate high risk for toxicity.
Yeah.
Severe EPS, over-sedation, and critically, that lethal QT prolongation we keep talking about.
So stopping an inducer is just as critical to manage.
Absolutely. The care team must anticipate this spike. When the inducer is discontinued, you need to make a corresponding significant reduction in the haloperidol dose. Often immediately, and you need rigorous monitoring for any signs of toxicity.
It's this terrifying push-pull effect. Add an inducer, Haldol dose way up. Stop an inducer, Haldol dose way down. Needs constant vigilance whenever any CYP-affecting drug is started or stopped.
Constant vigilance is the key phrase there. Now let's look at the other side of the coin. Enzyme inhibitors, drugs that slow down metabolism.
Right, so these would cause Haldol levels to build up.
Exactly. Strong inhibitors of either CYP3A4 or CYP2D6. This includes some common SSRI antidepressants like fluoxetine, Prozac, or paroxetine, Paxil. Certain potent antifungal drugs like ketoconazole.
Okay.
These drugs basically trap haloperidol in the system for longer. So plasma concentrations rise, sometimes significantly.
And higher levels mean higher risk of
toxicity. More EPS, more sedation, and again, dangerously compounding the risk of QT prolongation.
So the intervention here is watchfulness and maybe cutting the Haldol dose?
Yes. Monitor closely for any adverse effects and anticipate that a haloperidol dosage reduction might be necessary to keep things safe.
Okay, metabolism is clearly a huge factor. Let's pivot to special populations. The elderly. Always a high-risk group for antipsychotics, right? Especially sensitive.
Exponentially more sensitive, yes. Geriatric patients are far more susceptible to pretty much every major adverse effect we've discussed.
Like TD.
Yes, tardive dyskinesia. Also acute dystonias, significant QT prolongation, severe orthostatic hypotension, that dizziness when standing up.
Which leads to falls.
Exactly. Dramatically increased risk of falls and subsequent fractures, which can be devastating in the elderly.
So the dosing approach has to be different.
Absolutely. The mantra is start low, go slow. Initiate at exceptionally low doses. The sources suggest maybe 0.5 milligrams orally, once or twice a day if it's being used for behavioral and psychological symptoms of dementia, BPSD, and then titrate upwards incredibly slow and carefully if needed at all.
And there are even regulations around this, aren't there, like OBRA?
Yes. The Federal Omnibus Budget Reconciliation Act, OBRA, puts strict limits on antipsychotic use in long-term care facilities, nursing homes. For BPSD, OBRA generally caps the haloperidol dose at 2 milligrams per day orally, unless there's very strong explicit medical justification documented for needing more.
2 milligrams max in LTC for dementia symptoms, unless proven otherwise. But really, the bigger principle here, based on the evidence, is just try not to use Haldol in this population at all if you can avoid it, right? Because of the mortality risk.
That is probably the single most important clinical takeaway for haloperidol and the elderly. These antipsychotics, including haloperidol, are not FDA approved for treating dementia-related psychosis, and they carry a black box warning.
Why the black box warning?
Because numerous large studies show they increase the overall risk of death in elderly patients with dementia.
Increased risk of death from what?
From various causes. Heart failure, sudden cardiac death, serious infections like pneumonia, and also a higher incidence of stroke and TIAs.
So basically, avoid if possible.
Avoid if at all possible. The Beers criteria, which guides safe prescribing in older adults, strongly advises against using haloperidol in elderly patients who have delirium, dementia, or Parkinson's disease.
Unless
the patient has a primary diagnosis like schizophrenia or bipolar disorder, or maybe extremely severe nausea and vomiting where other agents failed. The standard of care is always to exhaust non-pharmacological interventions first for BPSD. Environmental changes, behavioral strategies addressing underlying medical issues. Try everything else before reaching for haloperidol in this group.
Okay, we hit the CYP metabolism interactions hard, which are critical, but now we need that list of absolute no-goes. The drugs that, if you pair them with haloperidol, create an immediate, potentially lethal situation. Mostly because of that additive QT risk, right?
Exactly. This list, you just have to know it. Memorize it.
Yeah.
Because combining these with haloperidol exponentially increases the chance of triggering torsade de pointe.
You lay them out for us. The contraindicated combos.
Okay, the definite contraindications include quinidine, an antiarrhythmic, Kimazide, another antipsychotic with high QT risk, sisapride, a GI motility agent mostly pulled from the market for QT issues but might still be encountered,
right?
Drondurone, another antiarrhythmic, potent azole antifungals like fluconazole and posaconazole, and the HIV protease inhibitor combination, sacrinavir ritonavir.
That's a serious list. Why these specifically?
It's usually one of two reasons, or both. Either they are major inhibitors of CYT3A4, which, as we discussed, will drastically raise haloperidol levels,
increasing its inherent QT risk.
Right. Or the drug itself independently causes significant QT prolongation. So you're adding QT risk on top of QT risk. It's just playing with fire.
Okay, so that's the never-ever list.
Yep.
Beyond those absolute contraindications, what are the major categories of interactions we need to watch out for? Let's start with drugs that basically fight haloperidol at the dopamine receptor level.
Right. Since haloperidol is a powerful D2 antagonist, it blocks dopamine, using it at the same time as dopamine agonists, drugs that stimulate dopamine receptors like levodopa, pramipexole, ropinirole, bromocriptine, which are often used for Parkinson's disease, is generally a bad idea.
Why? They just cancel each other out.
Pretty much. Haloperidol will block the effects of the Parkinson's meds, making the Parkinson's symptoms worse. Or, conversely, the dopamine agonist might counteract the antipsychotic effect of haloperidol, potentially worsening psychosis. You generally want to avoid this direct antagonism if possible. Maybe look for an atypical antipsychotic with less D2 blockade if you need an antipsychotic in a Parkinson's patient.
Okay, avoid dopamine agonists. Next big category, the risk of knocking someone out completely. Additive CNS and respiratory depression.
This is a huge area of concern, especially with polypharmacy. Combining haloperidol with opioids, think fentanyl, morphine, oxycodone, hydrocodone.
Common pain meds.
Very common. Or any other CNS depressants that includes alcohol, benzodiazepines, lorazepam, Ativan, diazepam, Valium, alprazolam, Xanax.
Also very common.
And barbiturates, though less common now. Mixing these creates an additive, even synergistic risk, meaning the combined effect is greater than the sum of its parts.
Risk is what exactly?
Profound sedation, potentially dangerous respiratory depression, severe low blood pressure, hypotension, coma, and even death.
So what's the practical advice? What if you have to use, say, Haldol and Ativan together, that B52 cocktail people talk about for extreme agitation?
Right. That combination is sometimes used in emergencies. But if concurrent use is absolutely necessary, the intervention is immediate. and requires careful judgment. You must reduce the usual starting dose of one or both drugs significantly.
Start lower than you normally would for either drug alone.
Exactly. And the patient needs continuous close monitoring, watching their level of sedation and critically their respiratory rate and oxygen saturation. That B52 combo is powerful, reserved for extreme situations, and the dosing has to reflect that dangerous additive effect.
Okay. Reduced doses, intense monitoring. Got it. Now, you mentioned a weird one earlier, that counterintuitive cardiovascular interaction with epinephrine.
Yes. This is a classic pharmacology trap. Shows up on exams sometimes. It seems backwards.
Explain it again.
Okay. Haloperidol, besides blocking dopamine, also has significant alpha-adrenergic blocking activity. Alpha receptors normally cause blood vessels to constrict when stimulated.
Right. Alpha stimulation raises blood pressure.
Correct. Now imagine a patient gets hypotensive, really low blood pressure, maybe from the haloperidol itself. The instinct might be to give epinephrine, which stimulates both alpha and beta receptors.
B usually raises blood pressure.
Usually. But because haloperidol is already blocking the alpha receptors, the epinephrine can't cause vasoconstriction. All that's left is its beta receptor stimulation.
And beta stimulation.
Beta 2 stimulation, in particular, causes vasodilation, blood vessels relax. So you get this paradoxical effect. Giving epinephrine actually lowers the blood pressure even further, potentially worsening the shock state.
Wow. So epi is the wrong drug for Haldol-induced hypotension.
Absolutely the wrong drug. Avoid epinephrine in this specific situation. If you need a vasopressor, you typically reach for something like norepinephrine, Levofed, which has stronger alpha effects, or maybe a pure alpha agonist like phenylephrine.
That's a crucial, potentially life-saving distinction. Good to know. Any final high-risk neurological interactions to flag? Seizures, maybe?
Yes, that's another important one. Haloperidol itself can lower the seizure threshold, makes it slightly easier for a seizure to occur.
Okay.
So if you combine it with other medications that also lower the seizure threshold, a classic example is bupropion, Wellbutrin, an antidepressant also used for smoking cessation, or maybe amifampridine, used for Lambert-Eaton syndrome.
Then the combined effect increases seizure risk.
Exactly. The risk goes up significantly. Doesn't mean you can never use them together, but it requires much closer monitoring for any signs of seizure activity, especially in patients who might already have a predisposition to seizures.
Okay, we have covered a massive amount of ground. Mechanism, indications, the nightmare of IV use, side effects from annoying to lethal, metabolism traps, deadly interactions. Let's boil this all down. Condense this whole deep dive into, say, the top five absolute highest yield points, the stuff you absolutely need for immediate recall, whether it's for an exam or, more importantly, at the bedside.
Right. This is your mental checklist.
Yeah.
The must-knows.
Okay. Point number one, that potentially fatal systemic reaction.
NMS risk. Neuroleptic malignant syndrome. Know it, fear it, respect it. It's a true medical emergency. Always, always be vigilant for that triad. High fever, hyperthermia, severe muscle rigidity, and changes in mental status or autonomic instability. If you suspect it, stop the drug immediately. Rapid supportive care is essential to prevent death.
Number one, NMS. Got it. Number two, the danger zone related to how you give the drug.
5-minute administration and QT prolongation. Remember, the IV route for haloperidol lactate is not FDA approved. It carries a high, potentially lethal risk of torsade de pointe, TDP. If it is used off-label in critical care, continuous ECG monitoring is absolutely non-negotiable, and slow administration, slow push, or infusion is mandatory to reduce risk.
Number two, high IV danger and QTC. Okay. Number three, those unavoidable movement problems.
Extrapyramidal symptoms, EPS. They are common. High incidence, 10% or maybe even higher for the acute forms like akathisia, restlessness, and dystonia, muscle spasms, plus pseudoparkinsonism. The clinical team has to be ready to recognize these quickly, tell them apart from worsening psychosis, and be prepared to administer antidotes like anticholinergics immediately. This is also key because acute EPS can be a warning sign for long-term irreversible tardive dyskinesia, TD, which is a huge concern, especially in kids on long-term therapy.
Number three, expect and manage EPS. Got it. Number four, the interaction that wipes out the drug's effectiveness.
Drug interactions, specifically the CYP enzyme induction. Remember this one. Using haloperidol concurrently with strong liver enzyme inducers, classic examples are rifampin and carbamazepine can absolutely tank haloperidol levels, cutting them by up to 70%. This risks acute psychotic relapse. You must anticipate needing massive dosage increases of haloperidol if an inducer is added. And conversely, if an inducer is stopped, you need an immediate significant dose reduction to prevent sudden toxicity.
Number four, Inducers kill efficacy. Stopping them causes toxicity. Critical dosing adjustments. Okay, and finally, number five. The big warning sign for our most vulnerable patients.
Geriatric contraindication for dementia-related psychosis, BPSD. Just avoid it if you can. Avoid using haloperidol in elderly patients specifically for dementia-related psychosis because of that black box warning, the documented elevated risk of death from stroke, cardiac events, pneumonia, etc. If use is deemed absolutely unavoidable after exhausting non-drug options, strict adherence to very low starting doses and regulatory limits like the OBRA 2-milligram cap in LTC is absolutely critical.
Number five, avoid an elderly with dementia due to mortality risk. Perfect summary.
You know, haloperidol really does remain an invaluable tool. It's a high-potency agent, especially for managing acute psychiatric crises. But that effectiveness is constantly balanced against this extraordinary volatility.
Yeah.
Every single dose, every calculation, every choice about the administration route, it has to be viewed through that lens of critical risk assessment. Especially when you consider other medications, the patient is taking anything affecting the QT interval, anything messing with liver metabolism.
Mm-hmm.
The potential for disaster is always there.
That critical risk assessment, that's the core of using this drug responsibly, isn't it?
It really is.
And that actually brings us perfectly to our final thought for you, the listener, to chew on. Given everything we've discussed, the extreme cardiac risks, the CNS effects like NMS and seizures, the high rate of disabling EPS and TD, plus the regulatory warnings, especially for vulnerable populations, what specific non-pharmacological interventions absolutely must be tried, documented, and fully integrated into a patient's care plan before you even consider initiating a volatile agent like haloperidol? Think broadly, behavioral strategies, environmental changes, communication techniques, addressing underlying physical needs. What needs to be exhausted first, especially in patients like the frail, elderly, or children, where the risks are so magnified?
Yeah, really consider that full spectrum of care. Don't just jump to the most powerful chemical restraint without exploring every other avenue first.
Something to think about. That wraps up our deep dive on haloperidol. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time.